If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to decolonize reality and embrace the fantastic possibilities of our enchanted world. It's time to intervene on behalf of human beings and all living things. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. So, like many of us on Team Human, Jeffrey Kripal has a bone to pick with the academic and scientific flatland that desouls the human experience in order to make us all easier to manage. His newest new book, Superhumanities, is a culmination of his career-long effort to decolonize reality from these efforts. At least one of his arguments is that by stripping away the fantastic or impossible parts of human history, things like visions, precognition, altered states, we have essentially lobotomized the humanities. And it's left us with a depressing and purely political version of ourselves. So Jeffrey is the guy I wish I had with me 25 years ago when I was arguing against the staunch atheistic materialism of those Epstein-funded scientists. Their refusal to acknowledge anything beyond the strictly material became, as I see it, justification for some heinous crimes against young women. After all, if there's no soul, what does it matter? So, Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining me. And thanks for all of your work over the years, which have been not just encouraging, but validating to so many of us.
I'm honored to be here, Douglas, and it's wonderful to be on your show.
I want to start with this idea of decolonizing reality, of how we move beyond the secular flatland. So in Superhumanities, which everybody should get, you argue that decolonizing isn't just about politics. It's about the ontology of reality, that we've kind of colonized the past by forcing every ancient culture into our modern secular materialist categories.
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, I wrote that book in a dean's office. I was associate dean for 4 years, and I was sort of looking out, you know, nationally and even internationally at the humanities. And there are really two arguments, or at least two arguments in the book. You know, one is a substantial kind of intellectual or theoretical argument about what makes the humanities. And the other is really what I would call a marketing problem, that we don't we don't actually have a story to talk about what we do in the humanities. We constantly work against ourselves in that we're always the bummers in the room. And it's not that we're wrong. It's not that the critical theories or the secularism or the empirical science is wrong. I'm not suggesting that. It's usually right. It's spot on. Mm-hmm. But it's also inadequate. It's inadequate to our humanity. And that's the critique of the book. Again, not that these critical theories or empirical sciences are wrong, but that they're inadequate and that we're something more or other than that. And so I'm really interested in this sort of what I call this vertical dimension, the strange and the weird. And it's only strange and weird because we assume that reality is only horizontal. Right. It's actually not strange or weird to our humanity or to other cultures or to other time periods.
I mean, it goes back to the idea that a lot of folks say we live in an evidence-based reality, you know, that anything you don't have evidence for doesn't really exist. But, I mean, in part, isn't the assumption that we live in an evidence-based reality an assumption as well, an unprovable?
Yeah. I mean, so what I do in the book and what I do in my other work is I like, look, we define what gets to be on the table that we'll talk about. And we take everything off the table that isn't consensual and repeatable and empirical in this sense. And then we say, oh, we can define everything on the table. And my reply is, well, that's just because you took off the table everything you can't explain. You know, you reduced everything to your physics or to your history or to your biology or whatever it is, whatever the worldview is. But people have these experiences all the time, Douglas. I would say that the extraordinary is not really extraordinary, or the paranormal is not uncommon. It's actually very common. And then what happens is that the culture, in this sense, this American culture, suppresses these things and keeps them down and presents the illusion that these things are not happening all the time, when in fact they are. Douglas, this will sound a bit cheesy, but I actually love intellectuals. I love scientists. I think they're really good people.
Mm-hmm. And
so what I do professionally is I come into an academic environment filled with humanists or social scientists or scientists, and I just start talking about the weird or the astonishing, but in the categories that they can understand. And I want people to be more comfortable putting these things on our table, and I want to address the naysayers and the skeptics as well as the people who are accepting of this and who the experiencers, as it were. I want to address both audiences, and I think that's what distinguishes the approach is that love or that embrace of both the skeptical positions but also the experiential positions.
Right. I mean, when I was in school, I was a pre-med theater major, you know, and I always looked to George Bernard Shaw and Anton Chekhov, that they were scientists. You know, they were scientists who also had sensitive spiritual experiences, romantic experiences even of reality. So we're not, you know, when I think about the superhumanities, I'm not just thinking about UFOs and precognition and retrocausality, but love. You know,
and also George Bernard Shaw. And I mean, he was actually one of the first people to bring the language of the Superman into the English language, by the way. And, you know, he was reading Nietzsche. And, you know, the argument of the superhumanities is that, I guess the bad news is that these are states that are not available to everyone. The good news is that we teach these texts to lots of people, and these texts then invoke or provoke these experiences in particular readers that we can't actually predict. So there's a kind of superhumanities embedded in the humanities canon that I think is powerful, and we need to embrace that and affirm that, and not just keep saying it doesn't happen or it's not important, because obviously it is important. And the people we think and the people we teach, including the playwrights, they didn't think their way to these thoughts. These thoughts appeared to them in general. They were in these extraordinary states or these altered states of consciousness. And so my argument is that to really understand the humanities, we have to take these all, we have to foreground or emphasize these altered states as actual states or ways of knowing the world. And they're not, they're not reproducible.
Right. And they're not, exactly. It's like Tylenol, at least we know, 82% of people will have this response to Tylenol. People, we cannot predict how people are going to respond to Three Penny Opera or Long Day's Journey into Night. Your mileage will vary.
That's an understatement. And then, let me play out the argument. Then there's this marketing problem, which I'm calling. My joke here is that 50 people showed up at my door last Halloween, 50 children, and half of them were dressed up as superhumans, and nobody was dressed up as a professor of the humanities, not a single kid. And I'm like, okay, that's why are we calling ourselves something that nobody wants to be? Why are we burying ourselves with language that nobody wants to follow? Why aren't we embracing the language that people actually want to be? Why? I mean, the superhuman is ours, Douglas. We invented it.
Right.
It's part of the canon. So why aren't we using it? Okay. Well, there's a lot of reasons. There's some historical reasons, and it's always fascist, or it's always depressing, or it's always this or that. But the truth is, it's not always fascist. It's not always depressing. It's actually ecstatic. It's transformative. It's what our religions are about for the most part. And yes, these have really bad moments in them, and really bad time periods. I understand that. And we should be critiquing that as well. So my call isn't to stop the critical theorizing. It's to do it and foreground the altered states and talk about all of it.
Right. I mean, it's interesting, and maybe it's an aside, but probably not. Just as you can give a fascistic anti-human tech bro some LSD, and he will become an amplified version of a fascistic anti-human tech bro. I mean, the humanities, in a sense, are non-specific amplifiers. Different Correct. People can take them in different places. I mean, everyone Correct. Calls Wagner a fascist, or maybe he was actually, but the music doesn't necessarily have to make you fascist. Like, everything Right. that Hitler liked and interpreted in that way doesn't make it evil.
No. And of course, to go back to Wagner, I mean, Nietzsche was Wagner's chosen intellectual. He was the person really behind a lot of or within a lot of this musical genius and the superstar status of Wagner in Europe in the 19th century. So that there is this link again to Wagner and the superhuman, and it just becomes fascism, as you said. I don't know that literature, by the way, but Nietzsche split with Wagner and is not responsible for the fascist uptaking of his.
Right. Just as I think Jesus would split with Trump,
he would be horrified. The Jewish rabbi would be horrified by what goes on in his name,
Exactly. It's what keeps happening. But on the simplest level, the one that I probably have talked about most in my own work is, the effort of, capitalism combined with technology to reduce human beings to that which can be quantified, monetized or measured, ends up negating or not just ignoring but repressing and almost violating the vertical dimension of human that you're talking about.
Absolutely. And, you know, we call it transhumanism. The transhumanism of Silicon Valley is not the superhuman that I'm talking about, because the transhuman is basically just the amplification of the human through technology and through computers. It stays on
a still material, right?
Still
even if they're going to the cloud.
It has this, and it's affirming that you spoke about psychedelics. People experience the vertical on psychedelics, and they come to know God on psychedelics, but they also come to know evil, or they have bad trips as well. And so taking all of that in is what I'm trying to call for, is like, and they also have some horizontal experiences. The psychedelics are these non-specific amplifiers, as you put it. And we need the insight that psychedelics are non-specific amplifiers. That's, by the way, a humanist insight. This notion of set and setting. That's like, of course, the context matters. The context actually helps determine the experience. So I'm not saying we shouldn't be suspicious of experience. Experience itself is part of this context. And by experience, I mean all of it. I mean near-death experiences. I mean psychedelic experiences. I mean social and political values. I mean all of it. We have the goods. Humanists and historians and philosophers have the goods. They can explain why these things are constructed. But what we don't do in the academy, and this will get back to the critique, is we don't apply the deconstruction to the deconstruction. We don't turn back the critical tools on the person or the form of consciousness making the criticism. And I think that's what we need to do.
Well, that's on ourselves, you mean?
Yeah. I think the critique of critical theory is that it doesn't go far enough. You know, we go on and on about how so-and-so, such-and-such is constructed, but I'm like, well, what's it constructed out of? It's constructed out of us. And there's always a mathematician, by the way, behind the mathematics. There's always a scientist behind the scientist. There's always a human behind the humanist. And it's that mystery or that presence that I want to foreground here.
Well, it's like it's... The other side of experience is intention, I suppose. You know, so we're negating experience because it's subjective, and then we ignore intention because, well, that's just, who cares what he wanted?
Yeah, and I'm not even saying that we should not be critical of experience, by the way, either. Experience itself is a dualistic category, by the way. There's an experiencer and there's an experience. There's something seen and there's a seer. And I'm trying to get, I think our sources go beyond that, you know, into some kind of non-duality or some kind of state that is beyond all that. And I'm like, let's talk about that. Let's not just talk about the dualism and and this is my real critique of science. Science itself is dualistic. You know, it's, you have a subject studying a set of objects, and you have a kind of back and forth there that goes on. And I want to say that there's something deeper than that. There's something more fundamental than that.
Right. And then, you know, and just at what I've been looking at in my work is that subject-object relationship was set up by scientists partly because they were afraid. Nature was scary and female and dark and systemic, you know, so if you could subject-object, you know, kind of kill the thing in order to take it apart and dissect it and analyze it, it became manageable, you know, and I understand emotionally why one would do that in a scary world of trees and worms and women, you know?
Yeah, there's a kind of violence that's integral or innate to our forms of knowledge, is what you're trying to say.
Right. Right. I mean, even our language, you know, it's a subject-object language system. So why wouldn't we, as we are now, emphasize kind of the figure over the ground? You know, it seems to me.
Right. And this is, again, but this is our this is the humanist context, is we're great at analyzing language, by the way. So why don't we just say that? Why don't we say all language is dualistic? It implies a subject and an object and a verb, and human experience of the universe is not grammatical. It's not about language, you know? I mean, a lot of it is, but some of it's not.
Right. And it feels like, I mean, that's why I became a media theorist. Another character you will not see at the Halloween party. We should come up with a new name for that. A reality hacker, I like better from Mondo 2000 than media theorist. But as a media theorist, you know, that's you know, what we do is look at how each media environment then kind of impacts our perception. So certainly the invention of language created a symbolic layer over reality. The invention of text then, you know, becomes a notch more. And now, you know, with the internet and these entirely symbolic landscapes on which we're interacting, of course we're going to end up leaving behind, you know, so many aspects of experience and becoming subject to an architecture. A logical architecture that we may not be fully aware of.
Yeah, you know, I mean, with media, Douglas, I mean, you're probably very aware of this, but the whole history of parapsychology or people's psi experiences follows technology very closely. I mean, the whole language of telepathy was really based on the telegraph, and then it became a radio, and then it was a TV, and now it's the internet and the computer, and blah blah blah. We're just kind of caught on these tracks, and what I'm trying to argue is we need to understand that's a track, and that our language and our technology is always coming out of us, but it's also determining what we're experiencing or what we're seeing. In a pretty dramatic way. And I'm interested in those moments where people don't follow the track. They're off the track. And like what's going on? What's happening there? Well, something's really interesting happening there.
Right. Well then, you know, and I used to read when I was in middle school. I read this guy, Ray Moody, I think was his name, wrote about life after life. And then John Mack wrote this book about people's UFO abduction experiences. And these were like scientists, like MD, Harvard, you know, legit people going, something's going on here. And they wrote it in this, they still got pilloried. You know, they got attacked for doing it. But they were just acknowledging, look at this, the multitude of very similar experiences. Let's see what's going on. And it raised me to think there's scientific explanations for these things, but we don't have them yet, you know?
Yeah. So first of all, I just taught Mac. I mean, I literally taught abductions. That book came out in 1994. And the Ray Moody book, Life After Life, came out in 1976. Ray Moody was a medical student when he wrote that book and then became a doctor. And John Mack was a psychiatrist at Harvard Medical School. I don't think what we call promissory materialism will get us there, Douglas. I think science is always this third-person external view of things. Mathematics itself is a third-person view. And I think what we're really talking about here is a first-person view, you know, a kind of experiential first-person experience of something. And the science is always coming in on the outside. And again, it's not that science isn't unimportant. Of course it is. But I don't believe for a second it will ever arrive at an adequate model. For these principled reasons, it's a third-person perspective trying to model a first-person experience. I just think it's a category error.
Right. And it's interesting because for a while, I would really be so excited when there was like scientific proof of something. You know, it's like, oh, the gut biome is real. Oh, homeopathy works because of this. You know, they find a mechanism, oh, human rapport and oxytocin and mirror neurons. Like as if, you see, now we've got the proof. But it's like that's such the wrong path to be even going down, to need to feel validated by the thing.
Yeah. You know, so Mac, to go back to Mac, I mean, I'm reading Mac right now. And so he wrote Abductions in 94, and then he wrote this book called Passport to the Cosmos in 1999. And really what Mac is arguing is that we need another worldview, that religion doesn't work and science itself doesn't work. They both, one relies on belief and one relies on reason, but they both don't work when it comes to people's actual experiences, and that we need some kind of future form of knowledge that we don't have, certainly in the West, and that there are connections to other cultures and to indigenous cultures in particular. But he was really arguing for something that doesn't exist. And he was not arguing for a promissory materialism or that science would someday understand it. Although there were, you know, to speak of this differently, there are definitely physical or material aspects to something like the abduction experience or the UFO experience. But that's the easy stuff. It's easy to show that there are marks on the body or there are landing marks on the ground or that, you know, these things are picked up by radar or whatever it might be. But it's really difficult. It's not clear how we deal with the experiential reports of the human witness. We just don't know how to deal with that. We don't have a way of understanding consciousness as itself part of the way of knowing or much less the alteration of consciousness. We just don't have it. All we can say is, oh, that's a hallucination, or that's a pathology, or if we're religious, that's a demon, you know, or that's something bad is happening. Well, none of those really work.
Right. I mean, and it was like, you know, the uncertainty principle in quantum kind of opened up a lot of people to the idea that, oh, well, if something could be in more than one place at a time, or things are communicating instantaneously, or two particles retain features when they're non-local, it's like, it on one level, it sort of relieved us of the responsibility to worry about that anymore. You know, it's like, time folds, space bends, whatever. It's like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, so again, I just finished a book on it's called The Physics of Mystics, and it looks at physics extensively, but how the physicists were reading mystical literature and how they understood these quantum mechanical principles in mystical terms. And it's interesting. It's not that they always understood as we understand mystical literature, but they clearly thought that there was an up here to the down there, as it were. And some of the things like Einstein's notion of relativity theory, I mean, one of the things that strikes me the most about that is that he would joke, you know, in the 19-teens that there were only three people in the world who understood relativity theory, himself and he couldn't think of the third guy. You know, there was this British physicist whose name escapes me right now, Arthur Eddington. So it was Arthur Eddington, Albert Einstein, and we don't know who the third person is. And the assumption, which I think is basically correct, is that you need a transformation of knowledge to even understand space-time and to even understand relativity theory. So there is this transformation that goes on in the physics community. But it never gets to what we're talking about. It doesn't. They abandoned fairly soon this notion of consciousness or this notion of altered states or mystical states, and they move into a shut up and calculate mode that becomes dominant and then builds the bomb and then creates this world we live in now. It's complicated. It's really complicated.
Right. But then the complicated, weird parts. And you write about this, and this is what I've witnessed. It ends up getting relegated either like to sci-fi or to comic books.
Yeah.
And it seems like on the one hand you think that's sad, but on the other hand, it's a zone to celebrate it. I mean, when in doubt, read Grant Morrison. You know, read Superman. You know, I mean, in some ways sci-fi sometimes it gets over. Justified also. Oh, it's a tachyon pulse. Blah, blah, blah. But in some comics, it's celebrated in just the form that a 12 to 14 year old needs to see it.
Clearly, I'm ambivalent about that. I mean, it's great. I mean, I wrote a whole book about comics and science fiction.
Right.
I mean, I was
Mutants
obsessed.
And Mystics. Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah, it's fantastic. On the other hand, it's as if we can only treat it as entertainment or as fiction. We can't say this is part of the world. You know, my other joke I tell a lot is, look, there are lots of visions of the future on Netflix, but they're all bad. They're all bad.
Right.
There's only dystopian visions of the future. There are no utopian or good images of the future. So why is that? And again, I think we're stuck on a track, Douglas. I think our science fiction and our comic books, we just tell the negatives or the bad story, but we don't think about the goodness of other human beings or of these phenomena. I mean, my other joke, and I'll just put this out here too, is I have never once met a demon that didn't look like a suffering human being.
Mm.
But so why do we do that? Why do we just pile suffering on top of suffering? Why do we demonize experiences and people when they're clearly suffering? You know, I think we should stop doing that. And we should embrace these people, and we should embrace these beings, because they're also part of this universe, you know.
Well, we're supposed to be scared of them. They're like succubi or demons that will possess the Linda Blair.
I mean, and so what I'm trying to say is, let's not be scared of them, or let's own our fear as a human response to something that's beyond us. But let's not say that the phenomena itself is fearful or terrifying or demonic. Let's own that. My other observation is it's likely us communicating with us,
yeah.
And we should listen. We should listen, because we might be speaking, and by we, I don't mean Douglas or Jeff. I mean, you know, some kind of greater we, and you know, poltergeists, by the way, never do good things. You never see rainbows and kittens. You know, you're always getting scratched, or something's breaking, or something's flying. So clearly there's trauma involved. Clearly there's emotional and often sexual suffering involved. And I think we're there, it's communicating to us to heal itself. You know, it's not communicating for the hell of it. It's communicating to be healed. And that's why I do sense a kind of healing impulse behind a lot of this phenomena.
Often I get concerned about thinking about talking about this work or getting too involved in this work, that I'm somehow ignoring the on-the-ground need for social justice activism in the real world. And I've been struggling in an ongoing way with whether this work, let's call it work, these practices, is it helping on some level? Is it helping the big picture on some level? Or am I rationalizing escapist occultism, you know, with as if it's doing something important? In other words, are we in a fantasy ignoring climate change, the Middle East, Ukraine, poverty, by trying to work on those problems in this way?
Yeah, I have multiple answers to that. I think we're doing good things, Douglas, obviously, or I wouldn't do it. I think a lot of the phenomena we study is from the socially marginalized and from the suffering. And so I think there's a unique kind of activism, a kind of social activism that's embedded in what we're doing. I also am of the strong opinion that when we talk to experiencers, they're often speaking out of a long history of self-censorship, that the social forces themselves have repressed or pushed down these experiences. And I suspect, you know, when we speak of like war or social injustice, I suspect that there's a lot of unusual things happening, and those are not being talked about. But if we did talk about them, this would further the social justice. This would not prohibit it. And let me give you an example. So I taught a course once on near-death experiences, and I had in the class a critical care nurse who worked in the military as well. And so veterans would be blown up, basically, in a vehicle, and they would have some kind of near-death experience, and they would be dramatically revealed to them that all things are light and love, and the purpose of a human life is to love. And so they couldn't come back. They came back and they're like, I can't be a soldier anymore, or I can't go kill people anymore because it doesn't match my experience. And of course, they were often told that they did have to go back into the field. And so this critical care nurse was the person between essentially the person who had the near-death experience and the military network that was trying to put this person back in killing people, essentially. And so I think there's an innately healing element to this work, Douglas. I really do. But I think it's difficult because it doesn't always follow the lines of our society or of our religions. To take the near-death experience, Ray Moody was completely rejected by fundamentalist or evangelical communities because there's hell, by the way, in that book. And there's no clear way that one's belief is correlated at all with whether one has a near-death experience. Everybody goes to the light. You know, everybody sees the light. So what are the religions saying? What are they about? Like, clearly that violates some religious worldviews. So I think that's part of what we're trying to say, or part of what you're saying.
And it doesn't have to violate, if you go back, it doesn't violate Christianity or Judaism. It violates these sort of modern dualistic interpretations, these linear. If you could understand heaven and hell not as a linear place you go in the future, but as an ongoing experience you're inflicting on yourself through your worldview and your actions, then all of a sudden, yeah, of course there's heaven and hell. I've been in both. You know, I've been in both.
I created it. I'm responsible for the heaven and the hell, you know?
Right, right. Then you go, oh my gosh. You know, and so you don't have to, it doesn't negate any religious worldview.
This is the problem. It really does violate particular religious and scientific worldviews. And I think we should make that part of our analysis is, well, come on, let's talk about that too.
Right, but there's still, in the worst of the say techno-scientific worldview that I've been studying, there's still an underlying drive for the thing we're talking about. So, like, I look at the internet, and the internet, it's such a sweet effort to kind of recreate the unimind thing in a discrete, tangible, well, I mean, that's what they do. That's what they do. God bless them. They're trying to make everything explicate, right? Explicate. There's like a, look, there's a wire connecting you and me. Thou, we're connected. And right. I look at it as a beautiful, sweet, childlike effort to manifest physically what they kind of know is sort of happening all along.
Yeah. I mean, hence this conversation. We're on the internet, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, but here's the problem. I mean, the internet and technology, it gives us all kinds of things like this, right? But it also gives us all the bad, you know? And so, for example, one of the things that I learned early on was the two most common professions of fundamentalist leaders around the globe is computer science and engineering, by the way.
Mm.
And if you talk to fundamentalist leaders, you can understand why. That these are very literal professions, and you blow the circuits if you start talking about religious texts as having multiple meanings. Because if you write code or you were building a bridge, there's only one, you can't have something that that's bad in the code or that's bad in the bridge, because the bridge will fall down or the code won't work.
Right. So you don't want ambiguity. But if you want to appreciate Torah, I mean, I did a comic book about Torah trying to argue that it's all these different stories happening at the same time.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. So that emphasis on ambiguity and a kind of multiple meanings is precisely what I think goes against this kind of literalism or this kind of scientism, as it were.
Right. Right. But when you oh God, how could you teach literature?
I don't
without
know
you that.
This is the thing. This is the thing, Douglas. There aren't many humanists in as fundamentalist leaders. They don't exist. Because what you learn when you teach literature or you teach media or you teach religion or philosophy, you learn that human beings are multiple and that there are many, many meanings of a text or a piece of art or a film. And it's really hard to be a fundamentalist leader with a black and white clear. I mean, it's impossible.
Yeah. But, you know, I remember I actually cried when this happened. My daughter was in ninth grade and they read Lord of the Flies. And she said they were talking, having a conversation in class. And she said that Piggy, you know, the one who's trying to save the thing, that Piggy represents technology.
Yeah.
Right, because he's got the eyeglasses that he uses to make the fire, and technology, and the defense of civilization, but technology. And the teacher said, "That's wrong." And I was like, "Wow, wow, wow!" You know that it. How could you teach a book and have a wrong? Anything, even if it was wrong, it could be wrong.
So
wrong.
You're being the good teacher, and that person's being the bad teacher.
Right,
you know,
but that they came
right
in.
Wrong answer.
But that they, and I shouldn't call about it they, but that this literalist scientistic worldview came into the humanities. It's come into our
it has.
Right and wrong, non-interpretive approach. And we must defend. We must defend the liminal, the weird, the multiverse.
Yep, I agree. And of course, the main challenge, you know, there's a lot of challenges today. But yeah, everybody wants to talk about AI and, you know, computers and
right.
This is again this third person idea that consciousness is just cognition or computer or it can be computed, and. I don't think interiority or this first-person view can be. And so that makes the humanities unique and special.
Right. Why it's amazing. And so many kids are writing their humanities papers with AI, you know, which is sort of it's going to be a feedback loop that it is going to prove itself sufficient, you know, which is going to be, that's a strange one. But the consciousness part, even scientists, some of them, they have a religious worldview, whether they realize it or not, because they'll say, oh, once a system becomes complex enough, like AI or maybe Claude tomorrow, there'll be consciousness is this emergent property, you know, that we from the outside will have no way of really knowing if they've reached it or not.
We can talk about that as a kind of reduction of consciousness to materialism. You know, this idea that something emerges from a material process is just magic. It's just like, what? Like, what?
Right. What it is that magic? Mean? Right. It's as magical as anything that that an occultist would say.
Yeah. And the Turing test that one can't tell if it's conscious or faked. I mean, the truth is that computers and AI are not conscious. And that doesn't mean they can't mimic or fake consciousness. They can't trick people. Of course they can trick people. People are tricked all the time. But that doesn't mean it's conscious. That doesn't mean there's an interiority or an experience involved. And again, I think that's what distinguishes the humanities from pretty much everything else is its emphasis on this interiority or this consciousness.
But wouldn't we as humanities people grant consciousness to rocks and things like that? Ocean?
Again, most don't, of course. We don't have an experience for the most part of rocks as conscious, although some people do. I mean, there, again, this interiority, I think, is key. You know, I wrote this book called The Flip, and you know, one of the basic ideas of the book is that this interiority or this consciousness depends on an experience, on being flipped. And most people don't have it, Douglas. They weren't flipped. And so they don't think this way. And I think that's entirely natural and understandable. And we need to think about that as well. Like, why are some worldviews not flipped and other worldviews are flipped?
Or some people have the flip experience but don't flip. You know, it's back to my, you can give 5 hits of acid to one of these dudes and they flip the other way.
Right. Or they flopped.
They flopped.
You know, the joke is they flopped. Or that, you know, we flop, or, you know, we don't clearly. But if you study enough of this and you see enough of this, it's really hard not to flip. It's really hard not to flip, at least intellectually, because you just see so much human experience that it just becomes overwhelming at one point. And they all can't be faking it or lying or there's some fraud involved or whatever the easy explanation is.
Right. And there's some people who are pre-flipped. You know, like Tyson Yunka Porta, Vanessa Machado de Oliveira, you know, people with some indigenous history, they've been flipped from birth. And just look at every, I mean, they have the advantage of having lived their whole lives without having split.
Yeah. And I'm not such a born flip person. I mean, that's not innate to me either. I'm like, but there are people like that I have met. And who are just different. They're freaking radioactive, you know, to use a metaphorical language. And I think we err when we think of these forms of knowing as somehow egalitarian or available to all of us. They're not. They're not available to all of us.
It makes me think about some of the ways we've tried, or our ancestors in this movement have tried to promote these sensibilities. And I'm thinking about your book on Esalen, was called The Religion of No Religion, the Esalen Institute, for people who don't know, the hot tubs and seminars and Terence McKenna and Maslow. And it was it still is there, a wonderful kind of spiritual retreat with hot tubs and courses that you would take. And the intention of Esalen was, it seemed like it, over time it got surrendered to self-improvement and, you know, biohacking and optimization. And I mean, do you think that there was in the central conception of Esalen, you know, like the New Age, that there were certain vulnerabilities, you know, that there were certain vulnerabilities that you kind of made it prey for, you know, capitalism or ego? Or,
I mean, all of these things, Douglas, I mean, they can all be used in different ways. And, you know, with Esalen, I know a lot about Esalen. A, I wrote the book, B, I'm on the board of trustees there. And so I think about Esalen a lot. And what's remarkable about certainly early Esalen is someone like Aldous Huxley, who helps birth Esalen. Well, we just read a Huxley for Brave New World. We read the depressing, deconstructive parts of Huxley. We don't read Island, which is really what he thought towards the end of his life and really what birthed Esalen or helped Esalen. So we focus on the dark and depressing, and we don't focus on the ecstatic and the mystical. And I'm not sure why we do that. And these ideas can be used for negative purposes. Absolutely. But that doesn't mean that's what the ideas are for, or what the ideas, how they were birthed in the first place. But yeah, they can always be used that way, and they are used that way. But I happen to think the counterculture in the 60s and what became the New Age in the 70s, 80s, they had a lot of things right. And today, you know, we just you generally see the phrase New Age as a takedown. Oh, this is New Age. Well, I'm like, well, why? Why is it a takedown? Why aren't we talking about Terence McKenna? And, you know, why are we only talking about the bad stuff, you know, or the way the conspiracy theories, you know, the people taking over the DC, you know, why do we just do that? That can happen, by the way. Once you posit that reality isn't what it looks like, and that there's some kind of alternative reality at work, it can go either way, or it could go every way. You know, one of my jokes is, if you really want a conspiracy theory, the humanities as a whole is the greatest conspiracy theory of all time. If you never want to believe anything ever again, just study the humanities, because you will never believe anything ever again. You will always be in this position of questioning things. And so I think that kind of suspicion is integral to education and to what we do. But of course it can turn into something
negative. It can backfire. Right. Yeah. I mean, Dana Boyd wrote a piece after January 6th, Dana Boyd, a media technology theorist, where she was arguing that in some sense, QAnon is media literacy's fault. That
yes. But well, he's right about that. I mean,
what do we do it then or not? Do we the argument was almost like to stop teaching critical thinking.
Here's the difference: is you can take QAnon and you can apply media theory to it in the classroom, and you can take it apart, you know, and you can look at it, and so that in that sense, it's not the same at all, you know, because you're critical of everything. You're not the thing with a lot of conspiracy theories is they're not critical of the particular conspiracy theory. There's a kind of literalism. Right. Embedded in it, and that is not part of the academic teaching environment. You know, everything is up for analysis.
Right.
There's a lot of powerful things about media too that, you know, need to be talked about as well. Some good things, and it's not all negative. And
no,
all of that needs to be on the table. You know,
exactly. Look at your books, my podcast. There's great media still being produced right now that you could buy. Go in the show notes and buy Jeffrey Kripal's books, because they would change your fucking life. But there's something else I wanted to talk about before we're gone, because I was looking at one repeating pattern. I mean, it's in Flip most explicitly, but it's in a lot of your work, is this idea that people seem to have these kind of traumatic experiences many times that then open them to the other great thing. And sometimes they even thank the traumatic experience, because had I not lost my leg, I wouldn't realize whatever. But what I'm wondering is, have you ever had the sense that maybe since 9/11, the pandemic, Trump, and the rise of authoritarianism, that we're certainly in America having maybe a collective traumatic experience that could open a more widespread collective understanding of the sort of the vertical self?
Yeah, no, I have had that idea, or had that thought. The problem is trauma is not predictable. You know, it can result in this healing impulse to heal the trauma, but it can also result in pathology and suffering and you know, madness. So this collective trauma that I do think we're going through, it can go either way, or it can go all ways all at once. And that's why I'm such a fan of the humanities, is because everything then is an object of critique, and we can talk about everything. But I really do think that the paranormal, or this verticality, is generally opened up through trauma. This is generally how human beings are opened up to it. Other than those human beings who are just open to it by birth or innately, but generally speaking, we need something traumatic to happen to us, and that's ambiguous. That can go multiple ways.
Right. I mean, even the pre-trauma of climate change, or the beginning trauma of it. It feels like it should be enough, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's enough for some people who are open to it and ready for it. But the thing with climate change that's so devastating is that it challenges lifestyle. And people don't want their lifestyle changed. It's easier to say it's not happening. The climate change is not or the ecological disaster is not happening. It's all made up. It's easier to say that than to question one's existence or one's livelihood.
Right. Even if that lifestyle, if they actually sat quietly and analyzed it, is the result of a whole bunch of civilizational choices that they would prefer not to make, you know?
Of course it is. It's exactly that. And again, this is the object of a lot of humanities scholarship, is showing those choices. And again, it's not the fault of the individuals. I mean, this is kind of what I'm trying to say. It's not so-and-so's fault or so-and-so's fault. It's this larger systemic background that really matters and that really results in these choices. Our choices are not free. We are mimetic creatures, to use the language. We choose what we're taught to choose. And I think this is a very difficult idea for people in general. My version of that is we believe what we're born to believe. You know, we're born into a particular culture in a particular time. And so we just assume that worldview. And I'm like, well, why? Why do we when you're introduced into this broader educational or global worldview, it's not at all clear why Jeff is just a Roman Catholic from Nebraska, or, you know, Douglas is just a Jewish figure from New York City. It's like, why? Why is that? Is that a function of just the accident of our birth, or, you know, a set of choices that other people made? Or is it something else?
Right. I mean, it's why also in superhumanities, it's really interesting that it's like a gentler and more fun approach to the decolonization effort. You know, when we're supposed to decolonize our scholarship, meaning you don't just look at the Tempest, you look at, you know, Caribbean interpretations of Caliban and things. So you bring in other things. But superhumanities, it makes the humanities so much more porous, so much less, you know, Western white canon.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly it. And it also makes it really cool, Douglas. It's like,
yeah.
Wow. I think intellectuals are really cool. And I think you're cool. And I think a lot of us are really cool. And I'm like, can't we just admit that? Can't we just say that? Why do we have to keep being, you know, selves that nobody wants to be, as it were?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the scientists went on an actual, you know, and I knew a lot of them. That was part of the mission of the Edge, was to make scientists cool again.
Yeah.
You know, which then ended up making them a little too sexy, and that whole other problems happened. But they made science cool. There's no reason. Humanities is becoming cool again. It starts with kids buying vinyl records. You know, it's the beginning back, or sitting at lunchtime reading books instead of swiping.
But does anybody know what the word humanities means? I mean, come on. Does anybody tell that story, or even, like, I'm just thinking about my own colleagues. I don't think any of them can tell you what the humanities are.
But tell us. Let's say it out loud then.
I think it's the study of the human, but it's in that. I think it's a study of consciousness coded in culture, is the way I would put it. And I think we have to question what a human being is. That's at the core of the humanities. And I think the human is superhuman. So I the superhumanities is my phrase for what the humanities really are. It's a study of altered states of consciousness that then become coded in works of literature, works of art, works of religion, works of philosophy.
Right. I've always looked at humanities, because of its name, as sort of an act of subjectivity.
Yeah, but again, how do you explain that? Like, what does that mean to the kids that show up at my door every Halloween? I mean, come on. If we say this is an act of subjectivity, we're going to lose them.
Right, but if I say it's an act of subjectivity, is what I'm saying is you get to become a reality hacker.
okay, that's attractive. that's cool. That's like great. Yeah, the humanities is reality hacking. That's the way to talk about it, you know? That's a story.
That's true. That's a story, right? And who should be good at telling stories but humanities people? But do you ever go to a humanities? You ever go to a conference of communications teachers? And they're like reading their, this is my paper on communications between people. Like, oh my God, you know?
I know, that's my point. And so my other argument, it's kind of a joke, but if we just put the super humanities on buildings, everybody would want to be a major. People would come to that and they're like, I want to be superhuman. I want to do that, you know? But of course we don't. We just keep calling it stuff that nobody wants to be again.
Right. You know, and it's funny because I was going to end by asking you kind of on a personal level, what is your practice? You know, do you do ritual? Do you do this? And it's obvious. It's the your magical occult practice is the humanities. You know,
it's writing. Duh. It's writing. My practice is writing, Douglas.
Yeah.
But I mean, writing is really weird. I think writing is super weird. Inspiration is super weird. It's the Eric Wargo stuff again. It's there's something magical about writing that can kick in.
Yeah, all writing is automatic writing, whether you want to believe it or not. You know, it's an element of it because it's coming from somewhere.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, it's going from in my head. Okay, fine. If that's it's coming from these cells in the matter of your brain. That's not weird.
And that's, of course, just a story. We don't actually know that. I mean, that's just a story that goes on.
But even that one analyzed objectively, or just if you tilt your head at it, that's just as weird as it's being beamed in from a quantum reality.
Or that it's emergent. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
That's like a break. That's a total cop out.
It's a hand wave. It's a hand wave. Oh my God. Dude, I'm so thankful for your existence. It's validating. You know, that's the thing. Your books are, I'm learning new things, but the emphasis for me, the communication, what's coming between the lines is validation of my felt lived experience.
That's intentional. I mean, I think what you're doing is great. And I want to, that's what the superhumanities is all about. It's to validate what intellectuals are doing, including those I don't agree with. I mean, that's part of the humanities is disagreement. And can't we disagree in a productive way? I mean, come on.
That should be the fun of it. That's why I went to the university, but it's not happening. I wanted to have scenes like in White Noise where they're sitting in some faculty lounge and arguing about, you know, Hitler, Elvis, or whatever. It's like, yeah, it's not happening. But that's all right. That's all right. I'll find the others.
It can happen on podcasts.
It'll happen on podcasts. All right. I'm going to find a staunch materialist who's willing to argue this way, and it'll be fun. but thanks so much for what you do. Everybody, get Superhumanities to start. Get the flip. You should just have the Esalen book on your shelf, because that's one you can just kind of go back to. You don't even have to read it straight through. It's just like stories about different moments. So start with those three. They'll all be in the show notes. And also, support the show. This is Team Human. We are listener supported. We're doing all sorts of new, important, great things for our listeners. So do come in, support the show. You get ad-free version. We're going to be doing Q&As, live once a month meetings of the team, access to a Discord where you can all find each other. Things are moving in all sorts of great ways. And if you can't do that, just support us by doing whatever the internet does there. Click, like, thumb, heart, share, review. There's all the platforms have ways of helping algorithms spread us to other humans. So do all that. Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you, everybody, for being on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
Okay.